And today we're going to be looking at Luke chapter 15, verses 11 to 32, which can be found on page 1049 of the Church Bibles. And Anjali is going to come and read the Bible passage to us now.
Jesus continued, "There was a man who had two sons. The younger one said to his father, 'Father, give me a share of the estate.' So he divided his property between them. Not long after that, the younger son got together all he had, set off for a distant country, and there squandered his wealth in wild living. After he had spent everything, there was a severe famine in that whole country. He began to be in need. So he went and hired himself out to a citizen of that country, who sent him into his fields to feed the pigs. He longed to fill his stomach with the pods that the pigs were eating, but no one gave him anything. When he came to his senses, he said, 'How many of my father's hired servants have food to spare, and here I am starving to death? I will set out and go back to my father and say to him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. Make me like one of your hired servants.' So he got up and went to his father. But while he was still a long way off, his father saw him and was filled with compassion for him. He ran to his son, threw his arms around him, and kissed him. The son said to him, 'Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son.' But the father said to the servants, 'Quick, bring the best robe and put it on him. Put a ring on his finger and sandals on his feet. Bring the fattened calf and kill it. Let's have a feast and celebrate. For this son of mine was dead and is alive. He was lost and is found.' So they began to celebrate. Meanwhile, the elder son was in the field. When he came near the house, he heard music and dancing. So he called one of the servants and asked him what was going on. 'Your brother has come,' he replied, 'and your father has killed the fattened calf because he is back safe and sound.' The elder brother became angry and refused to go in. So his father went out and pleaded with him. But he answered his father, 'Look, all these years I've been slaving for you and never disobeyed your orders. Yet you never gave me even the young goat so I could celebrate with my friends. But when this son of yours who has squandered your property with prostitutes comes home, you kill the fattened calf for him?' 'My son,' the father said, 'you are always with me, and everything I have is yours. But we had to celebrate and be glad, because this brother of yours was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found.'"
Thanks very much, Anjali. Please keep that page open. We will look at that a bit later, although we're not working through a Bible passage in the way that we normally do. What we're doing, we've been doing over the last few weeks, this is the last Sunday, looking at this theme, "You Can Change." And looking at the good news that coming to know Jesus and receiving him into our lives, it sets us free. We see the truth about God with his help and by his grace, and that sets us free in all kinds of ways. And we've been looking especially at these four truths about God and the difference that they make. God is great, so we don't have to be in control. God is glorious, so we don't have to fear others. God is good, so we don't have to look elsewhere. And then today, we're looking at the last one. God is gracious, so we don't have to prove ourselves. And that is a very liberating, wonderful thing, because we live in a culture, we live in a world where we are always having to prove ourselves. It starts when we're small children, with our parents. You've got to behave well if you want approval. You've got to do what you're told. You get in trouble if you're not doing what you're told. We learn it then from friends as well as we grow up. And if we want a girlfriend or a boyfriend, we feel like we have to be funny enough or cool enough or clever enough or thin enough or good looking enough to win their approval and their love. As at school and then as students, we're constantly being assessed, aren't we? Getting given grades and marks and qualifications. And it carries on in the workplace, in the working world. We're always dealing with targets and goals and appraisals and performance reviews. In fact, work is a massive one in Western society. Work is for a lot of people, it's how we prove ourselves. It's how we show that we have value and worth and contribute something, and how we kind of justify our existence. So a sociologist with a name that I can't really say, I'm going to try, Zygmunt Bauman from Leeds University. He said this is how we see work now in the modern world. He said we see work as self-fulfillment, the meaning of life, the core or the axis of everything that counts, the source of pride, self-esteem, honour and deference. And so for a lot of people, life feels like a bit of a rat race. However much we do, however hard we work, it will never feel like enough. And then we had the pandemic, we had the lockdowns. For a lot of people, then that suddenly felt like a relief. Just a moment off that constant cycle. And lots of people not wanting to get back into it and not wanting to get on with it. There's something at the moment that is being called quiet quitting. So you actually carry on in your job and nobody can see the difference except that in your mind you're not really bothering anymore. You just do what you have to get through the day and get paid. But you've actually stopped caring. But stopping work with this kind of culture and this kind of attitude, stopping work is also a very difficult thing to do. People find it very hard to transition into retirement or to stop work in order to care for children for a while, because they're asking themselves, well, what am I for now? If they're not able to work for health reasons or whatever else, it can feel as if people around you are saying, well, you're not really worth that much now. Because we, in our society, we think we need to justify ourselves and prove ourselves by what we do. And religion can be like that too. People trying to prove themselves to be good enough for God, trying to give enough to charity or carry out enough religious rituals and prayers and pilgrimages. And the wonderful good news is that Jesus sets us free from that. He comes into our lives, he gives us his Spirit, and he enables us to start believing the truth. And that sets us free, that we don't actually have to prove ourselves at all. God, because God is gracious. That's what I want us to think about for a few minutes now. God is gracious. What is God like? Gracious means that his undeserved love is quick to forgive. And at the moment we admit our sinfulness, our wrongdoing, the moment we turn to Jesus to be forgiven, God rushes to meet us and welcome us with open arms. So we read this in Nehemiah 9, verse 17. And actually, this is a little saying in the Old Testament. I could have quoted this from any number of different books of the Old Testament, lots of different psalms, from Exodus, from any of the prophets. You're a forgiving God, gracious and compassionate, slow to anger, and abounding in love. That's what God is like. Merciful, kind, forgiving. One of the stories in the Bible that sums it up the best is the one that we just had read to us just now. It's very famous and it's very popular because it captures so well what God is really like, his gracious, merciful love. The story of a son, a lost son, who leaves home and then return. So let's have a look at it again. It's on page 1049 in the Red Church Bibles. It's about a son who comes home. He didn't expect to be forgiven. It's there it is, page 1048, Luke 15, verse 11. As he returns home, he's practicing a little speech in his head that he's going to say to his dad when he sees his dad as he's walking along. And his speech is really saying, look, I'm not worthy. I've kind of lost my chance to even be seen as a member of the family. I'll be disowned now. There's no way he's going to take me back as a son. But just maybe I can beg and I can admit how wrong I've been. And maybe he'll take me back and I can just do a bit of work for him as a hired hand. And no wonder he felt that way, because he knows how he treated his father. He knows, look, let's just read what he says in verse 18, chapter 15, verse 18. I will set out and go back to my father and say to him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. Make me like one of your hired servants. He's no longer worthy. Because he asked his dad for his inheritance early, before his father even died. It's as if he's saying, Dad, I wish you were already dead. I want what you can give me, but I don't want you. In fact, I'm going to turn away and leave home, and I'm going to go to a distant country. I'm going to get as far away from you as I can get, because I want your stuff, but I don't want you. Then he wastes all the money on wild living. And it's a picture of you and me. It's a picture of all people and how we treat God. We want the things that God gives us, that he made, that he put into our lives and into our world. We want to take as much of that as we can, but we don't want him. We go as far away from him as we can. We kind of act as if he's not there, as if he were dead, as if he didn't exist. In fact, sometimes we manage to convince ourselves that he's not there and that he doesn't exist, so that we can just enjoy his stuff without him. And here's what the son says. It's like a prayer. Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you. But just look at the father's response. Chapter 15, verse 20. So he got up and went to his father. But while he was still a long way off, his father saw him and was filled with compassion for him. He ran to his son, threw his arms around him, and kissed him. He's still a long way off, down the road, on his way home, and his father sees him. How is that possible? Well, I guess it means that his father has been waiting and watching and hoping all this time that his son might appear in the distance on the horizon at the end of the road. And so the moment that he does appear there, the father isn't kind of waiting for the apology or the explanation even before he gives his little rehearsed speech. The father is running towards him. Fathers didn't really do a lot of running in those days. I have to admit, I'm not massively into running myself. Children like to run. I would rather walk at a leisurely pace unless I'm really late for the train or the bus. But this kind of father with his kind of beard and his kind of picks up, I guess they had cloaks in those days, and runs, very undignified, but he runs and he throws his arms around the son and gives him a massive hug. And then the son is like trying to kind of get out the little speech that he's rehearsed, but the father doesn't seem very interested in that. The son said to him, Father, verse 21, Father, I've sinned against heaven and against you. I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. But the father said to his servants, quick, bring the best robe and put it on him. Put a ring on his finger and sandals on his feet. Bring the fattened calf and kill it. Let's have a feast and celebrate. For this son of man was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found. So they began to celebrate. That is what God is like. A gracious, loving God who just lavishes enthusiasm on any of us as we come home to him. Whatever we've done, however far from him we've gone, however we've behaved, he just loves to welcome us and forgive us. God is gracious. And if that is what God is like, then that means we don't need to prove ourselves. God is gracious, so we don't have to prove ourselves. And in the moments when we believe that God is like that, and are trusting God to be like that for us, in those moments we stop trying to justify and prove ourselves all the time. Because actually this story carries on, doesn't it? It's not just about the son who comes home, who receives God's love and grace. It's also about the older brother too. And Jesus has two sons in the story because he's speaking to two groups of people. So if you glance back at the beginning of the chapter, chapter 15, you've got the tax collectors and sinners gathering around to hear Jesus. They're like the younger son who need to hear this wonderful promise of God's love. Just come back to God, however far away you are, and he will love and welcome you. But there's also verse 2, the Pharisees and teachers of the law muttered, this man welcomes sinners and eats with them. You've also got the people who, well, they've lost sight of the fact that God is gracious. They ought to really be people who know that about God and belong to God. But when it happens, they don't actually like to see God being forgiving and gracious, because in their heads, you have to prove yourself and earn things and deserve things to get things from God. And the older son, the picture of the older son that Jesus gives us is a picture of our hearts in those moments when we lose sight of the graciousness of God. And just want to notice four things about that And the first is the resentment. So verse 28. The elder brother became angry and refused to go in to the party, to the celebration. So his father went out and pleaded with him. He's angry. He's sulking. He's full of resentment. He doesn't want to celebrate grace. He doesn't want to be pleased that his younger brother has been found and restored and rescued. He's thinking, well, I never ran away. I never did any of those terrible things. Why should we be happy about that? He hasn't earned this. He hasn't deserved this love from God. He's a bad person. He should get bad things. I'm a good person. I should get the good things. I've been working hard to prove myself. And you and I might sometimes feel that kind of resentment. Do you find yourself sometimes brooding and angry and frustrated, and you're replaying a conversation that happened earlier that day and struggling to get to sleep? And in the conversation, you're kind of making a really compelling, convincing case for how you were in the right and the other person was in the wrong, and you kind of want that to be recognized and for others to see that. Drafting an email and redrafting it just to prove ourselves, to justify ourselves, to show that we were in the right. Resentment. And then also there's overwork when we lose sight of grace. Verse 29, chapter 15, verse 29. But he answered his father, look, all these years I've been slaving for you. That's an interesting word, slaving. He doesn't see his father as a loving father, as a family member. He doesn't work for his father out of kind of delight and to please his father and out of a good relationship. He feels like a slave with a slave owner. And when we lose sight of how gracious God is, we sometimes find ourselves serving him not because we want to, but because we have to. Not out of joy, but out of duty. And we feel it's all a very massive burden, and it's very stressful, and it's kind of endless drudgery. That's what religion is. A kind of slavery. So it's possible, isn't it, to love and serve God out of gratitude and praise for his graciousness, out of devotion to him. Imagine a young man, he's cooking for his girlfriend, he's very excited she's going to come round that evening, he really enjoys doing it, he puts all the little touches to the food, he's chosen her favourite recipe, he's put some flowers on the table, some candles, a little champagne glass with an engagement ring inside it. And he's really loving doing it. And then the next day he goes to work and he cooks another meal. But he works for McDonald's. He's on a zero-hour contract. He's got a horrible boss who shouts at him all the time and bullies him. And he hates it. And it's drudgery. And serving God for us, it can be a joy if we know him as a gracious, loving, forgiving God that we've really kind of given ourselves to in devotion. Or it can be a harsh duty if we imagine him to be some kind of ruthless slave owner. God is gracious, so we don't have to prove ourselves. Resentment, overwork, and then also in the older son, you might notice the legalism. Chapter 15, verse 29. I never disobeyed your orders. Never. Not once. There's an attitude sometimes to God that is like that, that God is kind of giving orders, and we just have to work to never slip up even for a moment and to keep all the rules. We think of God like an army captain shouting out rules. Religious legalism. And if we are religious legalists, we're always interested to know, well, is that sinful or is that not sinful? Because if this is sinful, then we just want to make sure we're not there. And if we're not there, then we've kept the rules and we start to feel proud of keeping rules. Of course, it doesn't really work. In order to keep the rules, you have to kind of lower the standards that God has so that you can be quite proud of how you've kept them. You have to make it about something a bit more. It can't really be about loving God and loving your neighbor, a heart thing, because none of us kind of fully manage that. So you make it about something you can manage. You make it about just orders that you can say you've always kept, and you have to make them orders that are quite easy to keep, a kind of ritual or a religious habit or something of that kind. Legalism And then finally, comparisons. Comparisons, Luke 15, verse 30. The older son says about the younger son, "This son of yours who has squandered your property with prostitutes." Now, actually, that's the first mention of prostitutes in the story. We don't really know if there were any prostitutes involved. We were told there was some wild living, whatever that means. Is he perhaps just assuming? Is he wanting to paint his brother in the worst possible light? Whatever's going on, he's definitely saying to his dad, "Look, compare the two of us. See how much worse he is and see how much better I am." I wonder if we sometimes find ourselves doing that, talking about other people's flaws in a slightly harsh way. Maybe we even quite like to think of other people's weaknesses because that makes us feel better about ourselves. We feel there's a comparison, we're winning in that comparison. We want people to notice how badly they've done so that they'll think how well we do. But even so, even with all of that going on in our hearts at times, God is gracious. What has he done do with the older son? Well, the same as he does with the younger son. Verse 28, his father went out and pleaded with him. Verse 31, my son, the father said, you are always with me, and everything I have is yours. Think of my love, he says. Think of my grace. Think of my generosity to you. We don't need to prove ourselves or justify ourselves. And why is that? Well, it's because God has already justified us if we're people who know and trust Jesus. So that word justified comes up a lot in the Bible. Here it is, for example, in Romans 5, saying to a group of believers, since we have now been justified by his blood. It's past tense. It's happened already. We have now been justified. We already have. That's already been accomplished. It's been done by his blood, by the death of Jesus. We count, we matter, we're forgiven, we're accepted. The work that needs to be done to justify us has already been done by Jesus when he died on the cross. As he died, he said, "It is finished." There is no more to do to prove ourselves or make ourselves right or make ourselves good. It happened when Jesus died on the cross by his blood. And if that has happened, if we're now already justified, if we know Christ, then how much more shall we be saved from God's wrath through him? As we look ahead to the future, we don't need to worry about God's attitude towards us. We don't need to worry that God might have wrath or anger towards us, or that when we meet him on the last day, will face his judgment. Not if we trust in Jesus, because we've already been justified. We've already been accepted. We've already been made right. And then Romans goes on to say, in chapter 8, verse 33, it is God who justifies. Who then is the one who condemns? No one. What does it matter what other people think? Why are we trying to justify ourselves and prove ourselves to other people? It's God who justifies. He's already accepted us if we had Jesus Christ. It's already done and finished. So who else has the power to argue with God, to disagree with God? Who can say to God, no, we're not. We need to work hard. We need to prove ourselves. We need to justify ourselves. That has already been done. It is finished. The rat race is over. So let's just finish again with that good news. You can change. With Jesus and his Spirit in your life, with the truth about God made known to your heart, you can change. And I just want to finish this series of talks with one last thought about how we change, and that is that it is going to take a lifetime. What we're going to need is a lifetime of daily change. Just because we've heard these truths and understood them doesn't mean that from now on we will be perfect and never struggle with these things. There's only ever been one great preacher who thought that it should be possible to reach a state of sinless perfection in this life. And that was John Wesley. He's an excellent believer and preacher. Even he made it clear that he didn't think that he himself had reached that stage of sinless perfection. He just said theoretically he thought it could happen. No other preacher before or since has really agreed with that. One of his followers actually thought that he had reached a stage of sinless perfection. So a friend decided to check out whether this was really the case and decided over breakfast he would pour a jug of milk over him and watch his reaction. Turns out actually he was sinful still after all, and it was helpful for both of them to be able to agree on that afterwards. We can't be perfect in this life. And so we mustn't be complacent. We can't just say, well, I believe the truth now. I have the Spirit now. It's all done. I can leave it at that. We need to believe those truths every day and in every moment. Don't be complacent. It's going to take a lifetime of daily change. Don't be complacent, but also don't give up. Don't think, well, hang on, I've already become a Christian. I already agree with these things you're saying about God. I've heard them before. So that hasn't worked because I'm still struggling and I'm still getting these things wrong. So it doesn't work and it's no point trying. No, that's not true. It does take a lifetime of daily change. You can change. You have got those truths, but you need to believe them. And in any given moment, on any given day, facing any given temptation, you don't have to sin at that moment. You will sin at some point in your life. You won't be perfect until you meet Jesus, but you don't have to sin here and now. Not if in that moment, with God's help, you're actually believing the truth about God. So there are bad habits in our lives, there are bad patterns in our lives, and that will take time to change. But we can learn good habits in our lives, and we can develop good patterns in our lives. As the River Clyde makes its way through Scotland to the sea, it has a lot of twists and turns and bends, and sometimes actually you can see from this kind of aerial view, sometimes the water is actually going in completely the wrong direction, not going towards the sea at all, but going away from the sea before it eventually heads back in the right direction towards the sea. And our lives don't go in a straight line. Our godliness and our holiness and our change won't always be heading in the right direction. Sometimes you might look at your life today and think, well, I was better yesterday or last month or last year. But one thing we do know is if we're followers of Jesus, we're heading downstream towards glory. We'll be conformed to the likeness of Jesus on the last day. All of that water is going to end up in the sea, and every follower of Jesus is going to end up in glory and perfection. So in the meantime, will we believe our beliefs? Will we let the truth of God set us free day by day? It might be worth finishing by just thinking, what change would you like to pray for? And would I like to pray for in my life? What truth do we want to take on more deeply into our hearts? It might be, for example, that God is great, so we don't have to be in control. It might be that God is glorious, so we don't have to fear others. It might be that God is good, so we don't have to look elsewhere. Or it might be that God is gracious, so we don't have to prove ourselves.